When Cecil Sherman arrived for his first Sunday as pastor of Broadway Baptist Church in Fort Worth, it wasn't exactly a hand-in-glove fit. It was more like a manicured hand in a work glove kind of fit. Broadway was refined elegance. Cecil was old boy common sense with a sharp wit. Broadway was pomp and circumstance. Cecil was pragmatic, get the job done. Broadway was poetry, the kind that doesn't even rhyme. Cecil was, just tell it like it is. On the first Sunday, neither Broadway nor Cecil knew just how good it would be in the years to come. And it was. At first, what Cecil understood is that these fine folks in this Gothic sanctuary with this big organ and tall steeple need to understand a few things about how church works. The best way to do that, he told himself, was to wheel out a big whiteboard into the sanctuary beside the pulpit. With black dry erase boards, with black dry erase markers on the board, Cecil went to work in his first sermon. I was a kid. This was great. It was the first time a sermon had actually held my attention. My older brothers and sisters in Christ, apparently, were not so enamored with the new preacher's style, from the first squeak of the marker through the end of the message. I think some of the big suits figured they'd gotten the wrong man for the job of senior pastor of such an esteemed congregation. That's not how things are done at a place like this. We liked our choir and long robes and our ministers to be greeted with respect at the Chamber of Commerce. We like them to be honored by the city council and to give invocations at banquets down at the club. Broadway pastors were leaders in a community of denominational exemplarism, not awkwardly squeaking markers on a dry erase board you couldn't even see from the balcony in the back of the sanctuary. What made things even worse is that this slow-talking, drawling, picture-drawing, hulking hayseed of a preacher used his first sermon to talk about church finances. Church finances. That's what refined people call it. Cecil called it money. He wanted to talk about money. The church's money. We were a church that didn't talk about those things, except occasionally among adults at business meetings, and certainly not with a whiteboard in worship in the sanctuary. We each had boxes of little white personalized envelopes at home to put our offerings in each week and check the box whether it was supposed to go to the building fund or the general fund. It wouldn't have mattered at all which box I checked with whatever I put in the envelope. As a kid, sometimes I would put spare change in one of those envelopes and put it in the offering plate when it passed, but I confess that most of those envelopes laid dormant in a drawer in our bathroom until they magically disappeared on some deep cleaning day of the house. That's what Cecil was worried about. He saw immediately in his new church that there were too many empty envelopes and not enough full envelopes. In his first sermon, he set out to make that plain. On the whiteboard, he drew a small circle. That represented the number of people who are giving substantially to the church. Then he drew a much larger circle around it. That represented the number of people who weren't giving anything or hardly anything to the church. As I recall, what he was pointing out was how a high percentage of the church's budget was being carried by a handful of givers. And that's not a healthy place for a congregation to be in. And he was naming it. It's not good for a few people to carry most of the burden. That's true in finances or anything else in church life. A church is healthy when people are bound together by their shared commitments to carry the work together. Apparently, the seesaw in that church was weighed pretty heavy in one direction. A few people on one end outweighed everyone else bunched on the other end. This was really interesting to me, though it didn't apply to me in any way that I could figure. I was a kid. I hadn't even embarked on my first paying job mowing yards. I was not in the inner circle of givers or of anything. And I doubt my parents were either, though I would learn years later just how quietly faithful and sacrificial they were in their giving in times when we hardly had anything extra. It was interesting for me, for whom it didn't apply, but it didn't go so well in the congregation among those who felt indicted. They were used to sermons that quote St. Basil, not bank statements. They were used to refined spiritual messages, not markers on a dry erase board sermons. And plus, everyone was nervous about any time that money and church were talked about in the same breath. This was the gilded era of TV evangelists who soaked their audiences with 24/7 appeals to send in your donations. And lots of people who could hardly afford to give their money to a preacher on TV did just that. Cecil didn't worry about any of that or what people thought about him. He just kept right on keeping on doing what he was doing. He was talking about tithing. He said, every Christian ought to give 10% of their income to the church's ministries. Except he said it like this. Every Christian ought to give 10% of their income to the church's ministries. Talk slow like that. It wasn't long before someone pushed back. We were an educated bunch, and some of us thought we knew better than what he was telling us. It was a Wednesday night Bible study in the fellowship hall. A man raised his hand, stood up. Tithing is nowhere in the New Testament, the challenger chirped. He was right. Tithing is not in the New Testament. Nowhere in the New Testament are Christians told to give a percentage of their income to the church. Cecil was confronted with the truth. He was also unflappable. He responded, "You're right. Tithing is in the Old Testament, not the New. In the Old Testament, they're supposed to give 10%. But take your pick which you want to follow. In the New Testament, you're told to give everything." And he was right, of course. When Christians talk about stewardship, supporting the church, and tithing, they're really talking about the bare minimum of Christian New Testament witness. The New Testament's idea of faithful discipleship is radically all in ways we can hardly fathom and wouldn't know how to live out if we could fathom it. In the New Testament, Christianity is hardly something you do on the side one day a week. It's not a feel-good place to season your life and its claim on our wallets. It's not a few extra bucks when we feel generous or guilty about it. It was life and death. It was all in. It must have been exhilarating. Famously, the Christians in Jerusalem sold everything they had and gave it all away to anyone who had need. The early church example is an inspirational story that's also one part cautionary tale. When Jesus didn't return as soon as they expected, the Christians who had sold all they had and given it away had to be supported by other churches from whom the Apostle Paul took up collections to send to them. Now, perhaps that's not the worst thing in the world. To be supported by someone else's generosity. We all are in different ways all the time, and in the largest sense, we're nothing but sustained by God's grace after all. At least being supported by someone else suggests some kind of relationship, which is better than being all alone. And so let's not make the Jerusalem Christians out to be in the worst possible situation, but still, few of us can hardly imagine willingly becoming purposefully, utterly destitute if we can avoid it. I've never seen a congregation decide to give away everything they have. This side of St. Francis, I've hardly seen preachers do so either, not even those who preach on the virtue of sacrificial giving. That's not to say I haven't seen sacrificial giving. I certainly have, and so have you. I've seen pastors live on nothing but beans and rice to give everything they have to the poor. I've seen college students give their dinner dollars to support missionaries. I've seen children give all their money from working all day at lemonade stands to help refugees. I've seen sacrifice and sacrificial giving. People giving away willingly, lovingly, more than any reasonable person would give because they said they felt like Jesus wanted them to. Christians all over this room and all over this city live on less than they could because they share generously with those who have less and because they believe in the church's witness to the gospel. Is that enough? Have we done enough? Cecil was talking, I think, to people who weren't doing hardly anything, trying to shake them loose from the tight grip they had on their wallets, or more likely, the apathy they had toward the church. It was more than about money, I think. It was about discipleship. He was trying to shake the tree. I don't know if the widow woman Jesus saw at the temple would have strengthened or undercut his sermon that day. If you were drawing circles that represent how much people give, she would be on the outer edge of the faintest circle. In the orbit of the shining Jerusalem temple, she's Pluto, barely even registering as a planet. She was so poor, it wouldn't matter what she gave. She'd never be in the inner circle if the inner circle is determined by how much you give. And so if our focus is just how much a person gives, she and her two pennies don't matter at all. But she mattered to Jesus. She mattered enough that he noticed her. He saw her. Never underestimate the power of sight in the New Testament. When Jesus warns people just before this to beware of the scribes who pray long prayers as pretense while they devour widows' houses, the word for beware of them is see them. See the scribes. See what they do. See them for who they are. Jesus wants people to see with gospel eyes. Gospel eyes don't just regard the outward appearance of things, but they penetrate to the truth. The truth was that those scribal folks were all puffed up balloons, and Jesus was the needle. Pop go the weasels. But see also the widow woman. See the widow woman lost in the sea of beautiful people. She doesn't fit in. She certainly doesn't fit in at the front door of the temple. Her kind are lined up at the back door, where the day-old bread is passed out to the poor among self-congratulatory pats on the back and philanthropy selfies. Her kind, the poor widow kind of people, the orphan kids, the strangers and aliens, there's a place for them. It's around back, not here in the front. In the temple, the money flows in the front and trickles out the back. And you know where you belong. Well, anyway, most people do. But she doesn't. She's got hardly nothing, but she's not here to beg for more. She's here to give the very last of what she's got. Watch this woman and watch her two pennies carefully. She's everything at this critical moment in the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus will soon face a final fateful choice between the way of the scribe's public honor or the way of the widow's last two pennies. When she drops her two coins in the treasury box and walks away, she's given everything. Literally, she put in all her living. Jesus doesn't say that she put in all her money. She says that she put in all her bios, her life. This isn't a story about stewardship. This is about biology. It's about life. This isn't about a little more money for a good cause. It's about a person who lays down whatever meager life they have left to give. This woman is not just a moral exemplar for being generous with our money, though she's that at least. She's an image of Christ. If this is about seeing, then what Jesus sees is a prophetic enactment of his own looming death just a few days from this moment. When Jesus points her out to the disciples, he's not making a point about giving money. They're way past that. Long ago, they'd made that bargain, dropping their nets to follow him. He's showing them what it means to go all the way, what it means to be the Messiah, and what it will mean for them to be his disciples. We never know her name. We never know what happened to her when she left with nothing. We never see her again unless we have eyes to see. If we have eyes to see, we see her in the Jerusalem church that sold everything and in those who gave to support them. We see her in Stephen, who was stoned, and Peter, crucified upside down, and Bartholomew, who was skinned alive, and Agnes, who was martyred with so many others. She's there beside St. Francis and Claire, in the slums of Calcutta with Teresa, raising the Eucharist for the last time with Romero among the cancer patients. She's in Hell's Kitchen with Dorothy Day and Walter Rauschenbusch. She's deliberating what to do with Bonhoeffer in Germany, and courageously with Pastor Trocmé hiding Jews in occupied France. She's here with us today. She's that part of you that's wild and untamed, wounded but not defeated, pushed down but not silenced. She's that part of you that's tired of playing safe, of clenched fists and tight wads, and of the deadening apathy born of the idea that I don't matter. She's been vacuumed up by the system, but don't call her a victim. She's in the voice that wants to cut loose, and the feet that want to dance, and the eyes that want to cry. And she's whispering in the ear of every rich young ruler who thinks he or she cannot give it all because they have just too much. And what she's whispering is freedom. A widow giving her last two coins, all she has to live on, is vision that fills the eyes of Jesus. He sees her, and in her sees someone giving everything they have, their whole lives. He sees a prophetic sign to him. You too can do what you know you must. As an image of church finances, she and her two pennies hardly matter. But of the gospel and of those who follow Jesus, she is our mother.